Welcome to the Whiskey Rebellion. This is David Silconet and Edinburgh, and joined as always by Frank Cogliano. How are you doing, Frank?
David, I'm great. If I were any better, I'd be you.
Wow, I'm not sure what that means. But thank you, I guess. Right, so this week's episode in some ways is a follow-up, a coda or a sequel to our last episode, which if you haven't listened to our last episode with Hillary Green, definitely go back and listen to that. But that episode we talked about the Black Lives Matter movement and the ways in which that has changed the monumental landscape. And we were talking mostly in that episode about its effects on Confederate monuments, especially the ones on the University of Alabama campus where Hillary teaches, but also more broadly. And obviously in the, I guess, 2 weeks since we recorded that, there have been a number of other Confederate and Confederate-ish monuments that have come down, like the monument to John C. Calhoun. But there's also been a more widespread reconsideration of the monumental landscape beyond those that are associated with slavery and with the Confederacy. And so we want to talk about some of those other monuments that have either been torn down by protesters or have been removed by various officials or where there are debates about their place on the landscape, some of which there's some questions about whether they should be there or not. And so these are sort of the, I don't know, Frank, my memory is we all basically agreed all the Confederate ones coming down were okay with that. But there's some other monuments where I think where there might be some more more discussion about whether they really belong or not.
Yeah, that's right. If I can interrupt and tell a joke at your expense, David. When we were coming up with a list of possible monuments to talk about today, listeners, this is not going to become a podcast about monuments. I think we'll probably be done after today. But we were coming up with a list. David came up with a number of Civil War era monuments related to Union figures, and many of those have been in the news recently, so that's entirely justified. But I did think this is what happens when you record a podcast with a Civil War historian. You do one on Confederate monuments, and now we're doing one on Union monuments, and he says, no, these are totally different.
So, and we're going to talk about Jefferson later, right, Frank?
So we're fair enough.
Yeah, we all play to our strengths.
Fair enough. Anyway, so yes, David, and I guess when we were talking about this in advance of the recording, one of the things one has heard, and we talked a little bit about this with Hillary in the last episode, is a prominent talking point, and we've heard this from President Trump, we've heard it from Kayleigh McEnany, his spokesperson, is, okay, but if we start doing this, where does it stop? And in fact, they usually say, are we going to take down Jefferson and Washington? And we'll get to that later in the episode. And I guess we want to actually try to answer that question, because a lot of the controversies of the past week or so have been about just where do you draw that line? And we've seen people like, Ulysses Grant, for example, come into question in San Francisco. We want to kind of try to address that question, where do you stop? Because it's easy, at least for us, we think, to agree that, you know, monuments to enslavers at the University of Alabama or John C. Calhoun in Charleston should come down. It's more complicated with some other figures in other locations, and that's the question we want to deal with today.
Right. Listeners, since we're going to be talking about physical items and artwork and whatnot, what I'm going to try to do is I'm going to try to put images of the monuments we're talking about in the show notes, so you can actually sort of see the things we're talking about. Because I think, at least with some of these monuments, what they look like matters, right? And I think they have the meaning of the monument isn't shaped by what it actually looks like, in addition to who the monument is of.
Yeah, aesthetics is an issue here with some of these, I think.
Oh, yes, definitely. Right, and one of the ones that aesthetics is definitely in play with is actually the first monument we want to talk about, and that's the Teddy Roosevelt Monument in New York City in front of the American Museum of Natural History. This is a monument Yes.
Yeah, sorry, David. Presumably you'd seen this as a child. I mean,
my parents lived about three blocks away from this museum when I was born.
Right.
So, yeah, this is a monument that I've seen many, many times. This is a museum that is very near and dear to my heart. It's a place I go back to you know, whenever I go back to New York, I always go back to this museum.
So can you briefly describe the monument for us?
So the monument is an equestrian statue of Roosevelt on horseback. He is flanked by two other figures who are obviously lower down than he is because they are not on horseback and they are somewhat back from him, of a Native American on one side and a African on the other side. It's a monument that was erected in 1939. So it's not a monument that actually originates with the museum itself. It's a monument that comes much later. The museum itself was actually founded in 1869. Teddy Roosevelt's dad helped found the museum. And it's at the location it's currently in on the Upper West Side since 1877. So, you know, Roosevelt has a very strong connection with the museum personally, with his dad, but also there are parts of the collection of the museum. If you've been to this museum, there's lots of sort of stuffed animals, and some of the, not stuffed animals in the furry give to children, but like, what's the word for this? Taxidermied animals that were shot by Teddy Roosevelt, who, among other things, liked to kill large animals. And so there's an elephant, for instance, that Roosevelt killed that's inside. So it's a museum. It's a monument that's connected to the museum in very personal ways. And the criticism of the monument essentially is that it seems to have embody certain kinds of racial hierarchies that are both present in the museum itself and that are present in Roosevelt's thought. Most art critics of the monument think that the two figures flanking Roosevelt are supposed to be personifications of continents, particularly of continents where Roosevelt did a lot of hunting. But the sort of the hierarchy is really the important feature here that people have pointed out that's objectionable. The museum itself decided to take it down. There have been a variety of protests directed at this monument over the past 10 years, but obviously more pressing ones in the past few weeks. And this is a move that's been endorsed by the mayor, Bill de Blasio, and endorsed by Roosevelt's descendants. Teddy Roosevelt IV and Kermit Roosevelt III have both said they're happy with the monument being taken down.
The interesting thing about it, David, is because, you know, and I'd seen it, of course, in place, and I completely support taking it down, especially given that...
yeah, it's a kind of a creepy monument.
Yeah, it is. However, if you took the three elements of it and just disaggregated them, so you had a statue of an African, a statue of a Native American, and a statue of Theodore Roosevelt on a horse... The statue of the two individuals who in the way the statue appears presently are clearly a subordinate position, and there's a racial hierarchy there. It's got to go. I don't get me wrong, but yeah. those representations are less problematic than some other representations. And I'm thinking, and we're going to get to the debate over the Emancipation Monument in Washington and Boston. I think back to there's a statue to Lewis and Clark in Charlottesville that I'm very familiar with that was put up in the early 20th century, which has an image of Sacagawea, the Shoshone woman who guided Lewis and Clark, but she's sort of kneeling behind them in a subordinate position. This statue at the Natural History Museum, as I said, if you just take the elements apart, those elements are less offensive. It's the way they're put together. Does that make sense?
I think that's right. Yeah. So if you put all three of these on display separately, much of the problem goes away. It doesn't entirely go away.
No. I understand that. But and there's a sort of they're presented as, they're presented in savage dress, as it were. I'm using that term advisedly. So there are problems with it, but they're not presented not necessarily presented as inferior beings as individuals. It's when you see them all in relation to each other.
Now, what does this monument say or what can we use this monument for, or the memory of this monument now that it's going to go away, to talk about Teddy Roosevelt's ideas about race?
I'm not sure what you're getting at, in the sense that, I mean, well, there's a lot to be said about Teddy Roosevelt's ideas about race, but, you know, monuments are very rarely about the individuals they're commemorating. I mean, I'm sure we've discussed this before. It says much more about people's assumptions in 1939. I'm surprised it was put up that late. I hadn't realized it's that recent. Right. That really does surprise me. But I think, look, Teddy Roosevelt was very much, and I hesitate to use this man of his time language, but he was a 19th century, you know, manifest destiny supporting, you know, whites have a responsibility to rule the world kind of guy. And it reflects that view.
Yeah, I think it does in some ways reflect he's got a very complicated relationship with race, both in the United States and in the broader world, right? You know, he's on the one hand articulated versions of white supremacy throughout his life. You know, he believed in social Darwinism and in eugenics. You know, on the other hand, the one thing he usually gets credit for is, you know, he has this very famous dinner with Booker T. Washington in the White House that infuriated white Southerners. Ben Tillman from South Carolina said that they needed to lynch 1,000 African Americans, and he didn't use the word African Americans. He said he needed to lynch 1,000 African Americans to put them back in their place after Booker T. Washington had dinner with Roosevelt. And Roosevelt spoke positively about African Americans who fought alongside him in the Spanish-American War. And so he's got a very complicated relationship with race, and in some ways the monument reflects that, right? So there's clearly hierarchies embedded in all kinds of things, but right. So that one's going down.
But what was interesting, David, before we move on, is because this debate about monuments, and this is something I want to get to later, I hope, is also becoming part of this broader a broader culture war. And so the way the right in America, especially those who are concerned about the removal of monuments and the so-called erasure of history, have latched onto this and said, they're tearing down Teddy Roosevelt, not actually saying, well, we're tearing down this monument to Teddy Roosevelt because of the racial hierarchy presented, which is the argument made by the Natural History Museum, the descendants, and frankly, by reasonable people who, and it's been fixated on as they're tearing down Teddy Roosevelt, not that they're that this statue was problematic. So it gets to the broader culture war that's going on in the country and the politics of it, I think. And we might want to park that or return to it later. But I think it's worth noting that the removal of this particular monument has been controversial. The monument represents different things to different people, in the sense that people of different political persuasions. I think people who are critical of the removal of monuments say, look, they're even taking down Teddy Roosevelt, not actually saying, well, look, clearly that one's problematic.
All right. And there are tons of monuments to him in New York City. So, it's not as if he will be forgotten there. Any short stretch of imagination.
There's been a similar debate and another monument to a popular Republican president, but that's controversial because of the way it depicts African Americans in this particular case, is the Emancipation Memorial. And there's one in the original is in Washington, but the copy is in, there's a copy of it in Boston, which I have seen for years and always thought, not sure about that. Can you talk a little bit about that, David?
Sure. So this was the Lincoln Memorial before the Lincoln Memorial. And it's a monument that was erected in 1876 by the sculptor Thomas Ball. And one of the sort of interesting thing about the story behind this monument is that it was paid for by formerly enslaved people, right? So they raised money, and the money came from people who were formerly enslaved. A lot of them people who had fought in the Union Army. There were various debates about what the monument would look like, and so even though if the money was actually raised by African Americans, the commission that actually decided what the monument looked like. Was made up of white people, but when it was dedicated, Frederick Douglass helped give the dedicatory speech. Supposedly he didn't like the monument, but he gave the speech dedicating it anyway. Grant was also there at the dedication. The composition has Abraham Lincoln holding the Emancipation Proclamation. It's got a liberated enslaved person, or a formerly enslaved person who's being liberated by Lincoln, I guess, sort of kneeling at Lincoln's feet, and Lincoln has his hand outstretched towards him. You know, the kneeling position there is what bothers people, I think, about this monument, because it definitely puts Lincoln, you know, in the superior position and the former slave in the sort of subordinate position. But I think it's supposed to evoke the very famous abolitionist image from the 19th century, the "Am I Not a Man and a Brother" image, which was popular among abolitionists on both sides of the Atlantic, which had a kneeling slave with his chains broken and sort of trying to make that linkage in the statue. You know, and I think historians, when people have been debating, and obviously this is a monument that hasn't been taken down yet, but there are debates about whether to take it down. I think historians are very divided about this one. You know, there are historians, David Blight recently wrote an editorial, said, no, we really need to keep this monument because of its origins as a monument put up by formerly enslaved people to Lincoln. On the other hand, I think, as you point out, it is a very problematic composition. You know, and I think that's the line that Frederick Douglass may or may not have said, and there's some debate about this, is that he would have preferred a monument that had a black man standing rather than a black man kneeling. What do you know, the one in Boston, you've probably seen a bunch, and I've seen the one in New York, or so on, in D.C. a number of times. What do you think about what we should do about this monument?
I don't know the history of the copy in Boston. Do you know anything about that? Sorry.
Was erected in shortly after the original. So the copy in Boston was erected in 1879.
Right. Okay. All right. So it's roughly contemporaneous too. Then, I mean, it would seem to me it's not a huge statue. And given its historic significance, I could see the case for putting it in, you know, put the Washington one in the Smithsonian and put the Boston one in the Museum of Fine Arts, and with appropriate context. But the Boston one's in a weird place anyway. It's kind of behind the transportation center in the fringes of the Back Bay. It's not, you kind of stumble across it. It's not very prominent anyway. So, I think those would be, and there's also an aesthetic, one might disagree with the composition, but aesthetically it's quite a striking piece of art. I think I'd put them in museums. I think these would be ones that shouldn't come down and be hidden, but might want to put them in museums and provide more context.
Right. You mentioned that these aren't very big monuments, relatively speaking.
No.
And the original plan, you know, when they were sort of raising money for this, was to have a much larger monument that would have included depictions of African American soldiers, you know, and it would have been a much more impressive structure. But as you would imagine, given that they're raising money from formerly enslaved people in the 1860s and 1870s, you know, who are for the most part desperately poor, you know, this was not an easy thing to raise money for. And so they actually had to scale down their original plans to what we ended up with.
So what do you think should be done, David?
Oh, this is a monument I use in teaching a lot, because it does sort of say some very interesting things about, you know, the question about who emancipated the slaves, which is obviously a very important historiographic question. You know, and to what extent did enslaved people liberate themselves? To what extent did Lincoln free the slaves? To what extent did the Union Army do it? And the sort of monument sort of allows for that conversation. You know, I think it's from its very beginning has been problematic because of the composition elements. The local twist on this is that
this seems to be the inspiration for the Scottish American Civil War memorial.
It does look a bit like it, doesn't it?
Well, it's basically the both statue. For those of you who don't know, we have a Civil War monument here in Edinburgh, right next to the grave of David Hume, which is interesting but means nothing as far as I can tell. Which has a statue of Lincoln holding the Emancipation Proclamation, and has an enslaved, a liberated slave, a formerly enslaved person. It's hard to tell from the composition, I guess, where the person's supposed to be in this process. But it's also in this subordinate position to Lincoln. In fact, the one in Edinburgh is even more subordinate. Whereas the one in D.C. has the person sort of kneeling at Lincoln's feet. This one actually has the African American figure below Lincoln's feet, sort of climbing up the pedestal in a weird way. And the one in Edinburgh was dedicated in 1893, and I haven't been able to find any clear documentation that the one in D.C. inspired the one in Edinburgh, but it's hard to imagine that they didn't, given how very, very similar the two monuments are. So you might want to have a debate about whether the one in Edinburgh belongs there or not, but that's in a graveyard, which is a different kind of location, I think, sometimes.
But, and it's also a monument to Scots who served in the Civil War.
And there's actually people buried there. Yeah. So, the question about sort of monuments in public spaces versus monuments on battlefields versus monuments in graveyards, I think there's, at least in my mind, I draw a slightly different rubric. For the Confederate ones, I'm happy to have the ones in the graveyard because the Confederacy's dead and they're dead and that's fine.
But David, you haven't answered my question as to what should be done with the one I'm watching. You've talked around it. You haven't answered it.
Your idea of moving this one to a museum, the idea of moving them to museums is problematic because I think most museums don't want monuments.
I understand.
And monuments are expensive, and especially monuments to white supremacy. So that's the argument for taking Confederate ones, putting them down in museums. That's a problem. This one I think would be okay moving to a museum because it is I think that it does have some artistic merit and some, this is one where if you put it in a museum and put some interesting contextual, plaques around it, to help explain the story behind this monument and then the story of why it was removed, I think that could actually be a really good exhibit in a place like the Smithsonian.
Particularly the National Museum of African American History.
Oh, that's yes. That would be a very interesting place to put it.
Yeah.
Or you could put, this is actually one where you could actually potentially move it around to different parts of the Smithsonian and have it speak to different, we could put it in the art museum, you could put it in the history museum, we could put it in the African American History Museum, you could
National Portrait place. Gallery.
Exactly, right. That would be great.
It's
portable.
So that one raises interesting questions about aesthetics, but also in the portrayal of enslaved or formerly enslaved people. That's kind of a theme that runs through the Theodore Roosevelt Monument, and the Emancipation Monument that we've talked about. One that has come up in the past week and been subject to some criticism, which you're probably familiar with, and I'm kind of acting as interlocutor because these are mainly Civil War monuments thus far, is the monument to Robert Gould Shaw, who commanded the Massachusetts 54th Regiment during the Civil War, which is on Boston Common opposite the Massachusetts State House. Those of you who've seen the film Glory will know the story of the 54th, etc. And this has been criticized in the past week for similar reasons to the Emancipation statue and the Roosevelt statue, because Shaw is on horseback. And in the background, it's a kind of frieze. It's not really a freestanding statue in the same way. Are the African American soldiers of the Massachusetts 54th Regiment? Do you have you must be familiar with that statue, Dave.
This is a very familiar monument to me. And they show it at the very end of Glory, the film about the 54th. And so it's whenever I go to Boston, it's a place I make sure I go and visit. The interesting thing about this monument and that composition is this is actually a monument that does get vandalized on a fairly regular basis. Like the people often break off parts of the way the monument is composed. It's actually a fairly delicate monument with some parts that are easy to break off. People break off parts of it all the time. And so it's been vandalized a number of times, and I think it's actually under repair at the moment. So there was people who spray painted some stuff on the plywood that was covering parts of it, as part of the Black Lives Matter protest. You know, the originally when they were putting this monument up, it was supposed to be a monument not to the 54th Massachusetts Regiment, but really just to Shaw himself, who commanded the regiment and who died at the assault on Fort Wagner in 1863. You know, and so they, after he dies, they plan to put up a monument to him, and I think it was like his family wanted to make sure that it included not only him but the men he died alongside, right? And so you know, that's why you end up with this composition where he is very much in the foreground and they're very much, you know, they're in less relief than his figure is. But, you know, in some ways the monument has the same problem that the movie does. You know, it's a movie about a black regiment, but they make the white officer the main character in the monument. I think it's the same sort of deal. But this is a monument, I think, that has some artistic merit attached to it. It's erected in 1884, so you know, in the lifespan of some of the men who fought in that regiment.
And it's produced by the sculptor Augustus St. Gaudens, who's a fairly important American sculptor of the late 19th century. I think this is different from the Roosevelt one. I mean, I understand why people might be, you know, I feel a little, you know, you can hear the reluctance about defending any of these, but the reason being, okay, so here you have a white guy on horseback and African Americans on foot. But to some extent, he was the commanding officer of that regiment, and so he was on horseback, and the African Americans are not cowering like in the Emancipation one, or as one could interpret the Emancipation one. I mean, they are armed black men marching to war. There's nothing, you know, there's nothing subordinate about that necessarily. So I don't think, I think there's an aesthetic quality to it that renders that we need to consider. But I also think that the actual depiction itself is less problematic than either of the previous ones we've discussed. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, how do you feel about that? I mean, this is a monument that actually means a lot to me. You know, and people say, oh, do monuments matter? This is actually a monument that, you know, I go and I have emotional feelings about, partially because...
Well, if you stand in the street to see it, you'll get yourself killed. It's really poorly located.
Yes, we got to get close to it in order to, you know... I think that it's a... Yeah, this one, you know, there are very few of these monuments that are not problematic in some ways. And anytime you depict a historical person, it's a, you know, the people are flawed, and in some ways monuments gloss over people's flaws. But this one, I think, has a merit for keeping.
I would also say, sorry, Dave, yeah, to interrupt, but. In and of itself, it's become an important site because of what it commemorates and because it's directly opposite the State House and it's on Boston Common. That has long been a site for protests, whether it's the Vietnam War protests or civil rights protests, you know, over the past century and a half. So as a kind of space of civic engagement, it's assumed an importance. And that monument is part of that, too.
Right. And I think that, you know... Shaw famously was buried in a mass grave by Confederates after the assault on Fort Wagner. And they did that to shame him, to bury him alongside African-American men. And they said, well, this is going to be disgraceful for a white man, an officer, to be buried along enlisted men of color. And his family said, no, actually, he would be very honored to be buried there alongside the men he fought with. And I think the sculpture depicts that. I mean, he's he's a complicated figure, and I think the monument, I think, reflects that. And if you look closely at the African Americans in the sculpture, I think they are depicted heroically, and they are depicted, they're individually. Each of the faces is different, and the sculptor took the time to make them fully human as well. And so I'm for keeping that one.
Yeah, I would agree. I would agree. Keeping it in situ.
Oh yeah, I think that it where monuments are located matters, right?
Which takes us to our next one, which is both a question of aesthetics, but a much more problematic figure.
Yes.
I think if we're questioning this case of aesthetics, which is the equestrian monument of Andrew Jackson, which is in Lafayette Square Park, directly opposite the White House. This will be an image a monument that's probably familiar to many people who visited Washington. Andrew Jackson, we've discussed on this podcast before. I find him a deeply problematic character. I know you do too.
I find him a loathsome character.
Yes, problematic. Yeah, yes, you're right. There's nothing problematic about it. I have no problems with Andrew Jackson. I know exactly how I feel about him. I have to confess, however, I like this monument, and I like where it's located. I don't like what it represents, so this is where I'm torn on this one. I like it aesthetically. It's quite a dramatic and striking monument, and if you've ever kind of walked around Washington, D.C., back when you used to be able to get close to the White House, and seen it, say, early in the morning around dawn or late at night or late in the afternoon at dusk, it's a very striking monument.
Right. And well, there's four of these, right? This is another one where there are copies. There's one in New Orleans, and the one in the original one is put up in the 1850s. There's a contest for who's going to do the Jackson Monument Clark Mills wins in 1848, and I want to talk about him in a second. They put it up in 1853, but there's a copy that's put up in New Orleans later that decade. There's a copy that's put up in Nashville in 1880. And there's a copy in Jacksonville, Florida, where they're going to have the Republican National Convention, that was put up in 1987.
Whoa!
Small footnote, I used to work in the Starbucks right next to the Jackson statue in Jacksonville.
Huh.
Right. There's four of these, both 19th century ones and 20th century ones. The guy who sculpted it's interesting. He was born, I think, in Pennsylvania. Clark Mills was born, I think, in Pennsylvania, but then he moves to Charleston, and he has in his sculpture studio enslaved people working alongside him. And in fact, the person who's probably his artistic partner was also a person that he owned, a man by the name of Philip Reed. And Reed seems to have been with Clark Mills, the person who sculpts this statue of Jackson. It depicts Jackson not as president, but as the victor at the Battle of New Orleans. So it's a young Jackson rather than a much more old figure like the one who's depicted on the $20 bill. And it's an interesting statue. It's one of the first bronze statues cast in the United States. I think it is probably the first monumental bronze statue sculpted in the United States, and it's the first equestrian statue that has both of its that's resting purely on its hind legs, so the horse is both of
which
its,
is what makes it so dramatic, actually.
Dramatic, right? This is a monument that has, if we sort of take aside the person on the monument and all the problems with Jackson as a proponent of slavery and of perpetrator of genocide against Native Americans. If you put all that aside, it in and of itself is a artistically significant statue. Whether that means it should stay up or not is a different question.
Yeah, I will concede my kind of hypocrisy on this question, just because I think it's a very striking. It's very striking aesthetically, and the location I think is really good, but I find it hard to defend this one.
Well, and the interesting thing about the sculptor, and this connects with the monumental landscape in D.C. So Clark Mills ended up then sort of moving to D.C. with Philip Reed, his enslaved artistic partner. Reed gets emancipated in 1862 when the enslaved people in D.C. are emancipated. That's a compensated emancipation. So Mills gets money for Reed's freedom. But then they together then are responsible for the Statue of Freedom on the top of the U.S. Capitol.
Oh, really?
So there's a connection between the Jackson Monument and the Statue of Liberty, or the Statue of Freedom. And obviously there were some debates about what that statue should look like on the top of the Capitol. But one could make an argument, and I'm not sure whether it's a good argument because I really loathe Andrew Jackson, that there's a merit for keeping it up for that reason.
I mean, is this one for a museum? One problem with it is it's quite large.
You know, it's huge. It's huge. It's pretty big. You know, it was put up to commemorate the anniversary of his victory it's put up in 1853 on sort of the anniversary of the Battle of New Orleans, which is a problematic battle, because the war theoretically was over then, and other reasons. It would be hard to put this in a museum, though obviously the one in New Orleans is also in a very prominent location. The one in Nashville is also in a very prominent location. The one in Jacksonville, you can throw that in the river. I'm okay with that.
Well, so I'm interested in so New Orleans makes sense because of the Battle of New Orleans. Nashville makes sense because of Jackson's association with, and in fact, he lived there. Jacksonville, of course, is named after Andrew Jackson, but did you say 1987 that was put
1987, up?
1987, yes. What's the story there? Do you know?
So I think that's when they built the Starbucks I worked was in a place called Jacksonville Landing, which was like the mall,
right,
on the waterfront, and they had some sort of renovations of the waterfront, and they had a new performing arts space that's sort of next to the Jacksonville Landing. The Jacksonville Landing actually came up in an earlier episode because there was a mass shooting in the Jacksonville Landing at a video game thing 2 or 3 years ago. But there were sort of renovations of the Jacksonville waterfront, and so that's when they put the statue up.
Right, okay.
The thing with thinking about taking down Jackson's present in the names of tons and tons of stuff. There are a number of, obviously the number of cities, Jacksonville is the largest of them, but there are Jacksonvilles or Jacksons in, more than a dozen states. There's Jackson counties in a dozen states, so his name is all over the place. But this one's tricky, because it does have artistic merit.
Well, that's it, and that's really the kind of aesthetic value is the only argument one could make for it, in my mind.
We're not iconoclasts. I thought we'd be taking all these down. It turns out we're not.
An interesting question, David. So one of the things that I've been thinking a lot about in this past week, and it's, I'm interested in the phrase you just used, which is iconoclast. I talked to a friend of mine, a good friend of mine, a fellow historian who's a very thoughtful person, and he made,
as all historians are,
well, of course, but he made the argument that this is a lot like the Reformation, this moment and the stripping of the altars, and this has led to some absurdities, and we might get to some of those, like in the past few days, like taking people down who don't seem to be that offensive, but in an iconoclastic moment. I mean, iconoclasm arises from the Reformation, taking down the icons. I think we want to be a little careful about that. And secondly, I have a larger, more prevalent concern, I think, or more prominent concern would be the way to put it, which is this is devolving into a culture war issue, which we saw a little bit over the Theodore Roosevelt statue. And I wonder if we're not expending a lot of effort and political capital at this moment over statues, mm-hmm. when we should be using that political capital and momentum to reform the police. So if this becomes the debate, this is actually a debate President Trump would love to have. He's talking about sending people to jail for 10 years if they pull down a monument or some kind of nonsense like that. But this plays to his strengths at some level. So the New York Post today had a story. I saw somebody share it on Twitter about supposedly activists want to replace the Star Spangled Banner as the national anthem because it was written by Francis Scott Key, who owned slaves, with Imagine by John Lennon. Well, we're not having Imagine as the national anthem of the United States anyway. But the New York Post, a right-wing populist Murdoch-owned newspaper, was promoting this. And you can imagine people reading that thing, see, they've gone too far. So I'm a little worried that this debate about statues, which we find interesting as historians, is actually might not accomplish it as much as we hope in the long run, and might actually take away from the more important political questions of the moment.
I agree with all that. I think on the other hand, one of the things that tearing down monuments does is it gives an outlet for righteous anger. I think sometimes the debate is framed as, should we tear down the monument or not tear down the monument? Should we tear down the monument or should we engage in a much more widespread form of violence, which may cost lives? And if people want to take out their anger on a statue of a 19th century racist, that's probably a better outlet than taking them out on actual people.
Sure, but let's not forget. I mean, there was violence in London 2 weeks ago as right-wing white supremacists sought to defend, and I'm using air quotes here, Churchill monument in Westminster, allegedly from the danger posed by protesters. We've seen some responses like that in the United States with people defending monuments. So this is not without danger.
Oh, to be sure. And so you mentioned Francis Scott Key, and there was a statue of Key that was torn down a week ago in San Francisco, along with two other, several other monuments in San Francisco, a monument to Ulysses S. Grant, and a monument to Juan Piero Serra, the Catholic saint and founder of Catholic missions in California. How do those monuments fit into our sort of developing rubric?
First of all, why was there a monument to Francis Scott Key in San Francisco? Do you know?
Yes, I do.
I knew you would. You know this.
Well, because I actually had a master's student who wrote his dissertation on it last year, for reasons. So the Key monument, which was put up, is the first of the three monuments went up. It went up in 1888. It was paid for by James Lick, who is this very strange gold rush millionaire who sort of grew up on the East Coast. At one point, he moved to Argentina. He was by trade a piano maker. He ends up, for a variety of reasons, moving to California right at the beginning of the gold rush and makes millions of dollars as a real estate investor, as a guy who was an early investor in the chocolate industry in California. He has a hotel that makes a lot of money. But on his death, he gives, he distributes his wealth to build a whole bunch of monuments, including one to himself, because, why not? He builds an observatory because he's really interested in astronomy. He's actually buried at the observatory. And he pays for this monument to Francis Scott Key. And exactly sort of why he wanted a monument to Francis Scott Key is not entirely clear. He just sort of said in his will, I want, these are the things I want, and here's my money, build them. Some people have hypothesized, in fact, that he, his love of astronomy and his, the fact that there are stars in the Spangled Banner and the, who knows. So he, it's paid, put up in 1888. And Key is best known, as you point out, for writing the what is later the national anthem. When this monument goes up, though, it's not the national anthem. It doesn't become the national anthem until, I think, the 1930s.
Yeah, that's right.
You know, so this is 50 years, almost 50 years before that. But Key is a more complicated figure than that, than simply the guy who happened to write a poem that later became the national anthem. You know, he was himself a slaveholder. He was the district attorney for Washington, D.C. under President Jackson. As district attorney, he imprisoned and prosecuted abolitionists who he saw as being basically insurrectionists. He was a member of the American Colonization Society, one of its founders, and so he was interested in which demonstrates he had some uncertainty with slavery, but he didn't believe in abolishing slavery. He believed in exporting people of African descent to Africa. So he's a problematic figure, Key is. And, you know, the Star-Spangled Banner is a problematic poem. It's problematic, especially in the third stanza, where he talks about most listeners probably know this, that it's about the War of 1812. You know, he speaks derisively about African Americans and derisively about people trying to escape slavery in the third stanza of the poem, which of course we don't sing because it's.
We never go that long.
Yeah. And I can't sing the damn song anyway.
It's a terrible song. I'm still slightly surprised that Key warranted you explain why there's a statue there. But you know, Francis Scott Key's just not that important a figure. And certainly not.
Well, there's tons of monuments to him in Maryland.
Right,
and
but
in
he was a Maryland guy. He's a Baltimore guy. So I get that to some extent. But the fact that there was a Francis Scott Key monument in San Francisco, I was unaware of that.
I think it's because Lick was a bit of a weird duck.
Right. Well, yeah, you've explained that. So it seems to me it does not do any great injustice to history to get rid of that one.
Right.
Now, I thought it was interesting that Ulysses Grant was attacked in the statue of Ulysses Grant was it pulled down or just defaced?
I think it was pulled down.
Right. Okay. As well as Junipero Serra, because one has a connection to the more explicit connection to the place, Serra, and there's a lot of stuff in California named after him actually.
Well, and Grant spent some time in California.
Right. That's right. That's right. So. Grant, the justification for Grant initially earlier in the week was because he had owned one slave in his life, and I'll let you deal with that because you know that story better than I do. And then kind of ex post facto, once there was a lot of pushback, at least on social media and elsewhere about that, and that fit the right-wing narrative of even U.S. Grant and Roosevelt. That's what they're coming for now. How ridiculous. But Grant, the narrative changed during the course of the past few days to being, well, yeah, but if you look at what the U.S. government did to Native Americans during his presidency, his monument ought to come down. There's a case to be made for that, but that wasn't the initial case that was made. Can you briefly tell the story about the slave that the enslaved person that Grant owned?
So, you know, Grant came from an anti-slavery family. His father had abolitionist tendencies, but he marries into a slaveholding family. His wife, Julia Dent, was from a moderately prosperous slaveholding family, and the one enslaved person that Grant owns seems that he got him from his father-in-law. The documentation here is not great. But he appears to have gotten received ownership of this man by the name of William Jones from his father-in-law, Fred Dent. And Grant emancipates Jones in 1859. That's sort of the one thing we know about this event with some certainty is we have this emancipation document filed, I believe, in St. Louis. Where Grant emancipates William Jones. What happens to William Jones afterwards, people don't know. There's some debates about that. How long Grant owned him, that's also something we're not entirely clear about. We do know that Grant is living and working on a farm that has enslaved people there, and so he is presumably overseeing these enslaved people that are owned by his father-in-law. His wife retains ownership or mistressness, mastery of an enslaved person actually into the Civil War that I guess belonged to her father, and that enslaved person runs away in 1862, I believe. And so Grant's relationship with slavery is very complicated. There's some really good work done on this by a guy who works at the National Park Service, a guy by the name of Nick Sacco, who's really sort of documented Grant's relationship with slavery prior to the Civil War. And Grant obviously later on goes on to fight to destroy slavery in the Confederacy. He has African American soldiers under his command. As president, he fights against the Klan and becomes a champion of black civil liberties as president. Does that redeem his complicity in slavery beforehand or not? And I don't know the answer to that. Some people have pointed out, well, maybe he grew and changed, and I guess he did. On the other hand, as some people have pointed out, only one slave is only one slave too many.
Yeah, I think there's a distinction to be drawn, and this comes up with regard to the argument about, if this, then Washington, Jefferson, etc. I think there are people we commemorate and celebrate with monuments despite things they've done. In the case of Washington and Jefferson, the biggest sin, of course, is slaveholding. And maybe Grant falls into that category. And again, it's debatable whether we should be doing that. But I think that as opposed to celebrating people with many of the Confederate monuments and neo-Confederate monuments explicitly for upholding white supremacy or slavery. So I think one
and Grant's a much better footing there than Jefferson.
Oh, totally.
Or Washington.
I mean, Jefferson owned 607 people over the course of his life, not one. And
Grant fought against the Klan and against the Confederacy.
Yeah, that's right. But I mean, just I think, especially where political figures are concerned, this might even apply to Jackson. You say, okay, he's a historically significant figure for a long period of time. I wouldn't put a monument up to him, but if there's an aesthetically pleasing one that's there, okay, maybe. I'm not sure about attacking Grant, removing Grant in San Francisco. I mean, if people want to do it, then fine.
San Francisco has a long history, and I think this goes back to the American Indian movement in the 60s and 70s of being associated with trying to look at this from Western eyes and looking at this from indigenous eyes.
Yeah, that's right.
And Grant doesn't come across very well if you look at him through indigenous eyes. In fact, he comes across as like most 19th century white Americans, like a perpetrator of genocide. And if that's the if your first framing is not of Grant as the guy who led the Union Army, but as Grant the guy who used the U.S. Army to displace and murder indigenous Americans, then it's very hard to sort of justify monuments to him. And why you would be angry at having a statue to him in San Francisco.
Yes, and there are plenty of monuments to Grant, including his tomb in New York City.
Which for a long time was very neglected.
Yeah, that's right.
If you think I was just went up and visited it just a few months ago before all of this stuff started. And you know, it's in good shape now, but for much of the 20th century, it was sort of abandoned and derelict, a place where you know, bought drugs, not a place where you thought about Grant as a person or as a historical memory.
Well, Grant, of course, has had the ultimate modern U.S. monument, which is dedicated to him, which is a Wrong Chernow biography, and he's having a moment because of that, and you know the series on the History Channel, etc. And so, in part, that accounts for the outrage about the removal of Grant. I don't think that would have been so 10 years ago necessarily, but so Grant's not in danger of being forgotten. So I'm fine with them removing that one. Sarah is an interesting character because he's an important figure in California history, but you know that's a complicated history, especially when it comes to the displacement of Native Americans. It was an interesting response this week by the Spanish embassy in Washington D.C. objecting to the you know the attack on the statue of Sarah, as well as there was a plaque to Cervantes also there that was desecrated in San Francisco, and the Spanish got involved with the Spanish government, or the embassy issued a statement and pointed out that Cervantes had been a slave, and they sugarcoated Sarah. Though I mean the history of the California missions is not a good one in the 16th and 17th centuries, and that was weird. And given the history in California, I think Sarah's a problematic figure. I know he's been canonized by the Catholic Church,
and very recently, like it was 5 years ago.
Yeah.
And you know, when that happened, you know, the Catholic Church said, look, here's this person who brought Catholicism and whatever benefits that brings to large numbers of people and Native Americans. And well, this is also somebody who was a imperial agent of the Spanish state and somebody who, you know, engaged in enslavement of Native peoples and was both directly and indirectly responsible for a genocide in California, which had a huge Native population before the Spanish arrived. And that the sort of missions, even if, you know, well-intentioned from the Catholic point of view, had just ghastly effects upon the people who lived there, both in terms of destroying people's lives and destroying a culture.
I think one thing that the Sarah statue underscores is one thing we haven't done. Most of this debate and most of this episode and our previous discussions have been, and I joked about it at the outset, have been about the Civil War and the middle period in American history, broadly defined, right? And we haven't really reckoned with the so-called colonial period and what it means historiographically, and integrated it into the national story in a very effective way, and in this debate. So that's interesting because it's a relatively rare case where a monument that commemorates an individual prior to the United States and the existence of the United States is at odds. I know there have been a few others, especially regarding
all the Columbus ones.
Right. Sorry. But they're pretty unusual. That it's relatively unusual because we haven't really reckoned with how to tell that history and make sense of that history. To some extent, the 1619 Project is very much about that. And I think we're going to see this possibly, COVID has disrupted this, but I long anticipated because 1620, you know, we're in the 400th anniversary of the arrival of the Pilgrims in Massachusetts, or in Plymouth proper, be more precise. And that may well, I feared that that would result in a sort of white nationalist kind of answer to the 1619 Project, and that hasn't transpired because we've had other things on our mind, although there's still 6 months to go in the year.
Goes this year.
But you're right, Columbus is an important exception. We talked about Columbus last week, but I think we haven't really reckoned with the colonial period in the same way we have with the Civil War period. We've got to wrap this up, David, but there's one that came down this week that I think we do need to talk about because of the – I feel sorry for the guy, which is Hans Christian Hegg. The statue of Hans Christian Hegg, which was taken down in Madison, Wisconsin, and was held up as an example of the extreme and idiotic aspects of this iconoclasm. Briefly tell us who Hegg was, and if you can, and I don't think you can, explain why they took down his statue.
So in full disclosure, even though this is a Civil War guy, it's not somebody I'd even heard of before this week.
Yeah, thank God I hadn't, but I'm glad you didn't either.
Okay, yes. he's a local hero in Wisconsin, but clearly hadn't come across my radar. But that's my fault, not theirs. He's born in Norway. He moves to Wisconsin with his parents. He goes out to California in the Gold Rush briefly, but then goes back to Wisconsin when his dad dies. He's involved in antebellum politics, first in the Free Soil Party and then the Republican Party. He's an abolitionist. He's involved in prison reform, and he seems to be a generally good guy. He goes and enlists in the Union Army, and he dies at Chickamauga in 1863. And the statue's put up to him in 1925 by a local artist.
And paid for by Norwegian Americans or something like that.
So I look very hard to try, and there are other monuments to him in Norway and a few other places. I tried to find something bad about this guy, and I couldn't find it. He seemed actually like the kind of guy you should put up a statue to. What does it mean that this is a monument that get pulled down and they get tossed in the lake? I think it means actually that monuments are really bad at teaching history, right? That if people are worried that we're losing our history if we take down these monuments, well, this monument was up for almost 100 years. I had no idea who the guy was. The people who tore him down probably didn't know who he was. They just saw him as a old white guy
in a uniform.
In a uniform, and they thought they don't, and they're ta- and I so I my reading of this. Is that they tore him down in a fit of passion over all the anger that is righteously come up as a consequence of Black Lives Matter movement and all the things we've talked about for the past several weeks. And he becomes the target for it. And I think they dredged him up, and I think they're going to put him back up. But I think this sort of speaks to actually how bad monuments are at telling stories about the past. If what they wanted to do in 1925 is for people to remember him and what he did, clearly that didn't work very well. What are your thoughts?
Yeah, I just think we shouldn't overestimate the level of historical literacy among the public.
Yes.
And I think
if you and I both didn't know who this guy was, maybe people locally in Wisconsin have a more nuanced reading of him than we do.
Or maybe, there are statues all over the place and you don't know who they're for. I mean, and I think this illustrates, the point the friend I spoke to earlier in the week made about this being an iconoclastic moment. Once you start taking things, I can just take everything down. And there's an anarchy, not anarchy as a kind of deliberately well thought out anti-political or apolitical movement, because there's an anarchic quality at the moment to some of this. I think, Madison's a college town. There are young people who've been energized and politicized by these protests, rightly so. And I think that's a welcome development. And I think they just went a little too far. I mean, I think fish him out and put him back up. And now people know who he is. And I will say, as somebody who's a little bit active on Nordic Twitter, there was a bit of a – which is a real subculture you want to explore. This did get a little bit of attention earlier in the week. I'm shrugging right now. You can't see me because there's no video, but I'm shrugging. that was one I thought, hot, never heard of the guy, read a little bit about the guy, thought, well, he seems nice enough. I don't think we need to tear him down. People get excited. Well, you know what? If the past 3 months of being locked down and everything else that's been going on in the world have taught us anything, and I think it's we need to give people the benefit of the doubt if we possibly can. And so I'm willing to forgive the good people of Madison, Wisconsin, and put the statue back up.
Yeah.
Not that they need my forgiveness.
No. Right. I guess time for last drops. Right?
Yes, David. So I want to recommend season 4 of Slow Burn, which is a podcast. It's nice to give a struggling little podcast nobody's heard of a little bit of a boost.
Exactly.
But season 4 of Slow Burn has just come out, or is coming out at the moment. Josh Levine is the main reporter this time, from who you may know from Hang Up and Listen, the Slate sports podcast, which is very good. But it's about David Duke and the kind of rise of David Duke in the 70s and 80s. I found Slow Burn really interesting because even when I think I know what it's about, I learn a lot about stuff that I lived through and, you know, vaguely remember. And this is up to its usual very high standard. So I can recommend the current season 4 of Slow Burn. What about you?
Okay. Well, I want to recommend two podcasts that aren't out yet, but the trailers were just released this week, and so they should be coming out in the coming months. And at least based on the trailer, they seem worth having on your radar. The first is Seizing Freedom, which is being hosted by Kadada Williams. It's made by some of the same people who made Backstory.
All right, great.
Most people know Backstory, the long-running radio show and podcast, is winding down. I think they're having their last episode, I want to say next week even. But some of the people from that are going on to do this story about this podcast series about emancipation and about the end of slavery. Kadada Williams is a very talented historian, and so that's going to be interesting. And I think speak, obviously, to this particular moment in interesting ways. The other one is a very different kind of podcast. It's called Welcome to Your Fantasy, and it's about the Chippendale Dancers of the 1980s. For those of you who aren't familiar, these were male exotic dancers, which was a new phenomenon. Obviously, female exotic dancers have a long history, but Chippendales was sort of trying to flip the tables, if it were. And it's hosted by Natalia Prezella, who is a historian at the New School in New York, and is some of the people who are involved in the Winds of Change podcast are involved in that. So both these podcasts come from people who know what they're doing and have done this kind of stuff before. So I'm excited about both Welcome to Your Fantasy and Seizing Freedom, although those are very different kinds of topics to be addressing in the podcast forum.
That's the joy of podcasts.
So,
David, we should say, I think this should be our last word about monuments for a while, unless something really big comes up.
Okay, fair enough. All right. Next week we'll do a non-monument related topic.
Excellent. All right. Cheers, David.
All right. See you later. Cheers.
The Whiskey Rebellion is hosted by David Silkenet and Frank Cogliano. David is a senior lecturer in American history at the University of Edinburgh, and Frank is professor of American history and Dean International for North America at the University of Edinburgh. The Whiskey Rebellion is available on iTunes, Stitcher, and Podbean. You can follow the show on Twitter at Whiskey Rebel Pod, and like the show on Facebook for updates about current and future episodes.